Introduction: The Hidden Side of Everything. Anyone living in the United States in the early 1990s and paying even a whisper of attention to the nightly news or a daily paper could be forgiven for having been scared out of his skin. The culprit was crime. It had been rising relentlessly. A graph plotting the crime rate in any American city over recent decades looked like a ski slope in profile. And it seemed now to herald the end of the world as we knew it. Death by gunfire, intentional and otherwise, had become commonplace. So too had carjacking, crack dealing, robbery and rape. Violent crime was a gruesome, constant companion. And things were about to get even worse, much worse. All the experts were saying so. The cause was the so-called super predator. For a time, he was everywhere, glowering from the cover of newsweeklies, swaggering his way through foot-thick government reports. He was a scrawny, big-city teenager with a cheap gun in his hand and nothing in his heart but ruthlessness. There were thousands out there just like him, we were told, a generation of killers about to hurl the country into deepest chaos. In 1995, the criminologist James Allen Fox wrote a report for the U.S. Attorney General that grimly detailed the coming spike in murders by teenagers. Fox proposed optimistic and pessimistic scenarios. In the optimistic scenario, he believed, the rate of teen homicides would rise another 15% over the next decade. In the pessimistic scenario, it would more than double. The next crime wave will get so bad, he said, that it will make 1995 look like the good old days. Other criminologists, political scientists, and similarly learned forecasters laid out the same horrible future, as did President Clinton. We know we've got about 6 years to turn this juvenile crime thing around, Clinton said, or our country is going to be living with chaos, and my successors will not be giving speeches about the wonderful opportunities of the global economy. They'll be trying to keep body and soul together for people on the streets of these cities. The smart money was plainly on the criminals. And then, instead of going up and up, crime began to fall, and fall and fall and fall some more. The crime drop was startling in several respects. It was ubiquitous, with every category of crime falling in every part of the country. It was persistent, with incremental decreases year after year. And it was entirely unanticipated, especially by the very experts who had been predicting the opposite. The magnitude of the reversal was astounding. The teenage murder rate, instead of rising 100% or even 15%, as James Allen Fox had warned, fell more than 50% within 5 years. By the year 2000, the overall murder rate in the United States had dropped to its lowest level in 35 years. So had the rate of just about every other sort of crime, from assault to car theft. Even though the experts had failed to anticipate the crime drop, which was in fact well underway even as they made their horrifying predictions, they now hurried to explain it. Most of their theories sounded perfectly logical. It was the roaring 1990s economy, they said, that helped turn back crime. It was the proliferation of gun control laws, they said. It was the sort of innovative policing strategies put into place in New York City, where murders fell from 2,245 in 1990 to 596 in 2003. These theories were not only logical, they were also encouraging, for they attributed the crime drop to specific and recent human initiatives. If it was gun control and clever police strategies and better-paying jobs that quelled crime, well then, the power to stop criminals had been within our reach all along, as it would be the next time, God forbid, that crime got so bad. These theories made their way, seemingly without question, from the experts' mouths to the journalists' ears to the public's mind. In short, they became conventional wisdom. There was only one problem. They weren't true. There was another factor, meanwhile, that had greatly contributed to the massive crime drop of the 1990s. It had taken shape more than 20 years earlier and concerned a young woman in Dallas named Norma McCorvey. Like the proverbial butterfly that flaps its wings on one continent and eventually causes a hurricane on another, Norma McCorvey dramatically altered the course of events without intending to. All she had wanted was an abortion. She was a poor, uneducated, unskilled, alcoholic, drug-using 21-year-old woman who had already given up 2 children for adoption and now, in 1970, found herself pregnant again. But in Texas, as in all but a few states at that time, abortion was illegal. As it happened, McCorvey's cause was adopted by people far more powerful than she. They made her the lead plaintiff in a class-action lawsuit seeking to legalize abortion. The defendant was Henry Wade, the Dallas County District Attorney. The case ultimately made it to the U.S. Supreme Court, by which time McCorvey's name had been disguised as Jane Roe. On January 22, 1973, the court ruled in favor of Ms. Roe, allowing legalized abortion throughout the country. By this time, of course, it was far too late for Ms. McCorvey Roe to have her abortion. She had given birth and put the child up for adoption. Years later, she would renounce her allegiance to legalized abortion and become a pro-life activist. So how did Roe v. Wade help trigger, a generation later, the greatest crime drop in recorded history? As far as crime is concerned, it turns out that not all children are born equal, not even close. Decades of studies have shown that a child born into an adverse family environment is far more likely than other children to become a criminal. And the millions of women most likely to have an abortion in the wake of Roe v. Wade, poor, unmarried, and teenage mothers for whom illegal abortions had been too risky and too expensive, were often models of adversity. They were the very women whose children, if born, would have been much more likely than average to become criminals. But because of Roe v. Wade, these children weren't being born. This powerful cause would have a drastic, distant effect. Years later, just as these unborn children would have entered their criminal primes, the rate of crime began to plummet. It wasn't gun control, or a strong economy, or new police strategies that finally blunted the American crime wave. It was, among other factors, the reality that the pool of potential criminals had dramatically shrunk. Now, as the crime drop experts, the former crime doomsayers, spun their theories to the media, how many times did they cite legalized abortion as a cause? Zero.